Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Movie Geeks United, the greatest program in the history of Movie Talk Radio. Tonight, join your hosts, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry, as they bring you an exclusive interview with special guest Anthony Giacchino, director of the new documentary film, The Camden 28, and John Swinglish, an original member of The Camden 28. Our topic of the week, where we ask, can movies really make a difference? And there must be flick picks of the week. To be a part of our show, pick up the phone and dial 718-508-9477. And now, here are your favorite cinematic fanatics, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Hello out there, everybody. I hope everyone's having a good Sunday evening. My name is Jamie, and this is Movie Geeks United. Welcome to the show. Our co-host Jerry is here with me. Jerry?
Hey, how's everyone doing?
Our third co-host, Chris, is going to join us the second half of the show when we discuss our topic of the week, can movies make a difference? The number to call is 718-508-9477. And if you're too shy to speak on the radio, you can always email us at moviegeeksunited@yahoo.com. First of all, Jerry, how's your weekend been? Have you seen any good movies?
I've seen some actually surprisingly interesting movies. It's really a shame because it's been a really nice weekend, too. The weather, I was tempted to do the show from outside in our backyard today.
Right.
But, no, I actually saw some interesting films this weekend. It's really odd the way this works. April is, Variety had this big article this week that, there's a glut of films coming out every week, and you have six films last weekend. You had four major films this weekend. Mm-hmm. And actually, you know what? Most of them are actually pretty decent. Surprisingly, the one that really stood out was Vacancy,
really?
Of all films.
You know, I had heard that Vacancy and Disturbia, that both of those are surprisingly good genre movies.
They are. I expected nothing from either one.
Yeah.
From the trailer, Disturbia is obviously a Rear Window for the millennial generation, but guess what? It works. The lead actor in this, Shia LaBeouf, who people know from The Battle of Shaker Heights and Holes, and A Guide to Recognizing Your Saints, he is the glue that holds the film together because, let's face it, you're stuck with the guy. He's under house arrest. If
right.
you don't like him, the movie's not going to work. But it works because of him. And he's a very likable. He has a great screen presence.
I'd really like to see it myself. Hmm. Do you know, though, that I think it was Chris that clued us into this, that Shia LaBeouf, I know we're destroying his name.
He's going to sue us.
Yeah. His name is Yiddish or something for Thank God for the Beef. Did you know that?
I did not know that, but I'm glad to know that now.
So every time I see him now, that's stuck in my head. I just thank God for the beef.
Well, as last night's movie, and I'm sure I forget who distributed last week's movie, they're saying the same thing.
Yeah, it's for the second weekend in a row, it's number one.
Yeah, it's interesting. A Vacancy, though, and I'll let you get to yours, but Vacancy is one of these movies that in the horror genre, when the films work, it's amazing because I think they say something about, especially since the 70s, where our country is at.
Mm-hmm.
And Vacancy has a lot to say, like Eli Roth's Hostel and The Descent, where things are going.
Horror movies have always been a good venue for kind of subversive social commentary.
Absolutely. I think one of the best examples of that may be George Romero's Night of the Living Dead films. Each
Absolutely.
One of them says something. The last one, Land of the Dead, while didn't really break any new ground, was his metaphor for the war on terror.
Exactly.
And dealing with terrorism. And basically, it's a very, in one sense, very radical departure from other films, is how to deal and possibly coexist in that kind of environment.
Yeah. Well, speaking of political statement films, our special guest this evening, we have the director of The Camden 28, which is a film which I saw this week. First of all, let me tell you, I've sat through 20 films at the Sarasota Film Festival in the past week, and that's why I'm standing up as I'm conducting the show tonight.
I don't blame you.
But it's been a great, exhilarating, kind of exhausting experience. But we're going to cover a lot of those films next week. I'll give everyone the scoop on, films like Lake of Fire, which is the 2.5-hour documentary from Tony Kaye on the abortion issue.
Right.
And, and Waitress, which is a big audience-pleasing film.
It sounds like it.
It's gonna be massive. It's going to be a big hit.
That's a bittersweet.
This movie just puts a smile on your face.
Yeah.
So I saw some good films there, but no film moved me as much as The Camden 28.
Okay.
And that's why I'm so excited about our guest this evening. And I'm so excited that I even wrote out a Charlie Rose-style intro. And, I'm wondering if you can do the Charlie Rose theme music for me, kind of hum it or something.
I don't know it. I haven't seen Charlie Rose in years.
Oh, come on.
I really couldn't, Chuck and I, we don't really go way back. I remember for one a PR job I used to have, I tried to get a couple guests on his show with no luck. So Chuck just doesn't do it for me.
Well, I think he's the best in the business, and I kind of emulate him. So I'd write up this epic intro here. You ready for it?
Yes, I am.
Okay, here you go. All right. In 1971, discontent over the raging war in Vietnam was spilling out into cities and towns across America in the form of chaos, riots, and economic devastation. This inspired the formation of the Camden 28, a group of anti-war protesters, many of them from the Catholic left, who set out in August of that year to break into a New Jersey draft board office and destroy as many files as they could. Little did they know, there was a mole in their group, an informant who had been working for the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, and hours into their operation, they were arrested and incarcerated. What followed was a 3.5-month trial that went down in the annals of legal history. For the first time before or since, every member of the protest group, both perpetrators and conspirators, were acquitted of all charges. In the new documentary film, The Camden 28, director Anthony Giacchino sheds light on this sadly forgotten piece of American history and shares a wealth of thoughts and insights from the group members themselves as they recall their actions some 30-plus years after the seminal event. Michael Atkinson of The Village Voice wrote of the film, "For aging radicals, The Camden 28 is something of a gift. For the under-30 conscientious, it could be an inspiration." It is my pleasure to welcome to the show the director of The Camden 28, Mr. Anthony Giacchino, and an original member of The Camden 28 and a defendant in that infamous trial, Mr. John Swinglish. Anthony and John, are you both there?
Yes.
I'm here. This is John.
Yes. John, it's Anthony. How you doing, Jamie?
Anthony!
Welcome to the show.
Yes. Wow, what a great intro. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I'm so excited to have you both here because, honestly, I saw many movies over the course of the week, but both my reaction and the entire audience reaction, it was just stunned silence, and they're very moved, and they applauded your film when it concluded, and it was just an incredibly moving experience watching your film, so thank you.
Yeah, thank you. That's nice to hear.
Well, I want to jot your name down so I remember. You said you're, what, Charlie Rose? Is that your name?
Okay. He's a lot better than Charlie Rose.
Oh, thank you, Jerry. Thank you, Jerry. We can all have dreams. I wanted to set the scene a little bit for the content of the film, and then we'll get into the actual film and the filmmaking process itself. But I want to start with you, John. There seemed to be a precedence for this kind of protest activity, the destroying of draft records prior to the Camden 28. I'm thinking about Milwaukee and Baltimore. But the Camden 28 really took it one step further. Could you discuss that a little bit?
Well, the actions actually started in May of 68, and October 67, I guess, was the Baltimore action. There were just four people. And then May of 68 was the Catonsville 9. And then there were a number of actions. Like you mentioned, Milwaukee was later that year, I think September, October, and that was 14 people. So they were getting larger and larger,
right,
and more popular, for lack of a better word. But they were going all the time. I mean, about once a month there was an action from early or late 67 when they started all the way through. Our action was in August of 71. And then there were even a few actions after that. I'm not sure what you're referring to when you say we took it a bit further.
Well, I'm thinking in
as far as the trial and the acquittal, you mean, or what?
Well, those actions were more kind of symbolic.
And the early ones were. That's right. Yeah. People did what we call standby actions, and they would literally stand by and wait to get arrested.
Right.
And they were very powerful actions, but as you say, very symbolic. And then at some point, somebody said, you know, we're losing a lot of our best people. They're all sitting in jail. How can we do this a little differently? And then we started doing actions. I say we. I talk about the entire community, that huge group of people that was involved in this, not just the Camden people, of what we might call hit and run, where you'd actually go into a draft board and destroy as many files as possible or remove as many files as possible and get away. And then later on, in a week or two, a month or two, whatever, we would do what was called a surfacing, release a statement at a public place, time and place of our choosing, and say, you know, on such and such a day this action took place, this is why we did it, and we're the people who did it.
Right.
And the feds really didn't have anything to bring to trial with those people, except their word that they did it, but that wouldn't necessarily stand up. But we were actually shutting down draft boards. Earlier actions were not actually shutting down draft boards.
Right, right. And you spoke in the film of the it wasn't just limited to the war in Vietnam, but it also kind of bled into the effects of Vietnam on the towns and cities, the devastation, especially in the Camden area.
Oh, yeah.
Could you talk about the correlation there?
Well, you know, obviously, I mean, they're spending, just like they're doing today, you know, spending billions on a war halfway around the world, and cities are dying. They're not even trying to make things any better. I mean, I'm not into giveaways. I don't think you can just pour money on a city and everything's going to be fine.
Right.
But they're not even trying to make things better. And they're spending billions on these things. At one time during the trial, Father Michael Doyle wanted to show slides of Vietnam and Camden. And the judge said, well, you can do it, but without comment. Because he wanted to do a running dialogue. They just showed the slides.
Right.
And actually doing it without comment was even more powerful, because you couldn't tell the difference. Mm. I mean, I was sitting there looking at those slides, and I couldn't tell the difference. Imagine what the jury was thinking. It was powerful. It really was. But we were making a statement about what's going on in the country or isn't going on in the country.
Right. You know, that's some of the most powerful moments of the film, too, when the group reunites in the courtroom 30-plus years after the initial event. We'll get to that in just a second. But first of all, who were the Camden 28? What made up the group?
Oh, Anthony knows as much about this as I do. They always say, you know,
I think, John, maybe what would be interesting is the fact that not all of you were from Camden. And how that worked, how they sort of drifted in from all over.
And not all of us were priests. People get the impression that everybody were clergy, you know, because that's, you know, that lead, so to speak. And there were a few Jesuits in there, some from New York. Father Michael Doyle was from Camden. There were a few people from Camden. They were looking for people to help them with the action. It had been in progress or, you know, in planning for quite a while, and they needed some help. So I don't remember how Paul Cooming got pulled in, but then Paul called me because, see, we had done actions before. I'd been involved in other actions before this. And Paul and I were down in Delaware previous year, I think it was. And so Paul calls me and says, hey, we're doing something up here in Camden. We need some help. And so, you know, what do you do? Those days I had no car. Got in a bus and went up to Camden. That was it. But there were people from up and down the East Coast, really. And it was just part of the network. And people called friends and said, hey, you know, we're doing an action down here. We need some help. And people would come in.
So the mission of the Camden 28, so to speak, the mission was to, after hours, break into the New Jersey Draft Board office, which was part of a larger federal building.
That's right.
And destroy as many files as you could, effectively shutting that office down.
That's right. That was the plan. Shut it down. Yeah.
And what was your role in the operation?
Well, you know, I helped with the planning and everything. The weeks before, and then the night of the accident, they did not go into the building. There were only 8 people in the building, and there were another 20 people. Some were not in town, but let's say roughly, you know, another 20 people, whatever, outside in different places. We had people blocking intersections and things like that, just so no cop car would drive by as folks are running up a ladder in the back of the building, you know, that type of thing. I was over at a row house that was the home of a minister, Milo Billman, who has since passed away. And it was just across the street, diagonally, from the federal building. So I could look out Milo's window and see everything that was going on. So once we got everybody in, I went over there, and I was in touch with Paul Cooming inside the building by these little walkie-talkies they used to have, you know, that all those little crystals in them, and you could, you know, go to different frequencies.
Right.
So just to keep in touch with, I think I was also in touch with some people who stayed on the outside. But mostly it was the folks in, what floor was that, Anthony? I never remember.
The fifth floor.
Fifth floor, okay. And so I could see the office from Milo's house and be in touch with Paul as they were moving through. And every now and then I would just check in with him and say, well, you know, how you guys doing? How much longer you have? You know, et cetera, et cetera.
So they were working to destroy these documents on the fifth floor.
They were tearing up as much as they could. They were also stuffing them in these old No. 2 mail bags before they had all these trays that they used to put mail in. They were just stuffing some of these big old gray No. 2 mail bags and carry as many of those out as possible. Because you really couldn't destroy them all in one night.
Yeah, but little did you know, like I said in the intro, that you had a mole in your operation.
That's right.
Someone that was trusted in the group.
He was a friend of a few of the people that were from Camden, because he was also from Camden. And they felt really betrayed by this guy coming into the group and then turning them in.
Of course.
As you would imagine, yeah.
Jamie, I have 2 questions.
Yeah.
One for Anthony and one for John.
Sure.
For Anthony, what was the inspiration for this film? And the reason I ask that is because it would be impossible, obviously, with the events of the last 5 or 6 years, not to, you know, you're making a film about the Vietnam War era.
Right.
Were you trying to use this as sort of a mirror for what's going on today? Like Altman's MASH is basically really about the Vietnam War, not Korea.
Right.
Right. And were you trying to say something about the events of today?
No. Well, I mean, I think it ended up that way.
Oh, of course, yeah.
That wasn't the intent. The intent was to tell the story of the Camden 28 because we started the film in 1996.
Right, right.
So, and it always had been to tell their story. And then as world events and history sort of, you know, changed around us, it just was looking more and more like the same situation.
It does. It's very interesting because I was thinking about this earlier today. Back, I guess it must have been in the early 90s, Francis Fukuyama wrote the famous book, The End of History, saying
right.
that basically everything was over.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, September 11th comes along and blows that out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought it was, you know, well, even if there was nothing going on today, it's obviously a very interesting story, and I applaud you for bringing it to everyone's attention, because before Jamie brought this up, I had never heard of it.
Right.
And I can't wait to see it.
Well,
but,
I'll just tell you that in the beginning, when I would say 95% of it or so was shot, and the first sort of go at the editing of putting the story together, it was a question in my mind of how much I should bring in the question of Iraq, because I had been to a number of these anti-war rallies leading up to the Iraq War, before the war started,
right.
with them. And so the very first time I actually put something together, that was in there. But then we just decided afterwards just to keep it with the story itself.
No, I applaud that.
Yeah.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah. And then that was the end of it. And at the end of the film, when you sort of get an update of what they're doing now, you see them at the rallies.
Good.
But that was put in there really just to show that they're still out there, that they still are making statements about this.
And I think even without the mention of the Iraq War by name, a viewer today, it's still, the parallels are still constantly running in their mind as they're watching your film.
Right.
Oh, absolutely.
Extremely relevant for this time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, when we were at the Philadelphia Film Festival, and we had a little reception afterwards across the street, that was the most asked question. People would come up to me that had just seen the movie and say, do you see connection or parallel between what's going on today and what was going on in Vietnam? And, you know, I just felt like carrying a sign around saying, yes, you know.
Yeah, but I think everybody that's good. That's good that people make the connection.
Oh, yeah, and some very young people. There are a lot of college kids there, of course. And, yeah, they were asking.
You know what I found interesting watching the film, and I didn't see this portrayed so much in the film, but you see it a lot today. Anytime that there's an anti-war protest, there seems to be a faction of people that claim that those protesters are un-American.
Yeah.
Did you get any of that feedback 30-plus years ago when you coordinated this?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it was always, I mean, because we also did a lot of, not just the Camden folks, but a lot of us were standing on sidewalks in front of the White House and everything, and people would drive by, you know, get a job, you know, love it or leave it, and all that kind of stuff, you know.
Right.
That old love it or leave it thing was, you know, a one-liner.
Yeah.
You must not love America.
It's never going out of style.
Yeah. And my feeling even today, you know, I support the troops, but I don't support the war. And my view of supporting the troops is bring them home so I don't get killed.
John, I have a question for you that does relate to today. And I was just curious because you're obviously involved in one of the most important protest eras of the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
There is obviously a protest movement alive and well in this country, but it seems very fragmented. It doesn't seem as to have a unified front as it did back in the Vietnam era. Am I wrong in thinking that, or?
You know, it's growing. It seems to me to be growing a lot more slowly than it did back then. You know, the Tonkin Gulf Resolution was in August of 64.
Right.
And by 67, I mean, there were people on the streets. You had that huge demo, I think, in Central Park, at the Pentagon.
Right.
We had the Mobin moratorium, and we're shutting down college campuses across the country. It just doesn't seem to have caught on or grown as rapidly as it did back then. I don't know. Maybe it's just my perspective.
I think you're hitting on something very important here, but is it because there's no longer a draft?
Well, I bet you that's part of it.
I mean, because I think that's the thing. We live in interesting times, but it's almost surreal. We have two wars going on.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, the families of the troops are really affected.
Right.
That's right.
I've always thought that, too. You can kind of, if you don't want to know about anything going on, you don't have to know.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's very easy to turn it all off.
It is.
Yeah. And I think the draft, it really did, as Mike Doyle says in the film, you know, it was the way in which the government reached into your neighborhood and your home and everything else and took your son for this war. And there were a lot of middle-class white kids dying over there. And there were a lot of middle-class white parents losing children. And
right.
They, you know, at first they couldn't bring themselves to admit. We've even heard this term used by a couple of politicians recently. Oh, it was a waste. Oh, they died for nothing. No one wants to believe their son died for nothing.
Right.
But after a while, like Betty Good, you know, you come around and you say, holy smokes, maybe he did. Maybe this just isn't worth it. You know, for people who don't know, Betty Good lost a son
right
in Vietnam. And one of her others, she had three sons, I think. Bob was on trial with us. And she sat in that courtroom, and she turned around one day, just listened to Howard Zinn talk about the history of the war.
Right.
And she said, oh, my God. And she took the stand the next day, and she blew us all away. She really did. She was incredible. But she had just been converted virtually the day before. And we ran into a lot of parents back then that just they didn't want to admit that their son had died for nothing. But later on, they would come around.
Right.
In terms of revisiting this story for the film, did you run into any kind of rejections from the members of the 28, Anthony?
Yeah, there were some who just didn't want to be interviewed for it, certainly. You know, we made every effort to speak with everyone. I mean, I think I got in contact with everybody. There were some who said yes, some who said no, thank you, I'm not interested. And yeah, it wasn't always easy. I'll put it to you that way. You know, because if you could imagine, I was a year old when this happened.
Yeah.
And there was some concern among some of them that, well, how can we really trust him to tell this story? What does he really know about any of this? But I just, you know, my tactic was just to sort of just be very patient and slowly and just try to keep coming back and talking and let people know what was going on.
What did you tell them that the thrust of the story would be?
Well, I think it was telling the story of the Camden 28, what happened in Camden at the draft board raid itself, the reasons for the draft board, and then the trial. Because, you know, I grew up not far from Camden, and only like 15 miles north of Camden, and I never heard of the story. I didn't know anything about it. And I would say that most people my age didn't know anything about it. So it was kind of strange to me that such a big event was almost forgotten, you know?
Right.
So that was also one of the, well, if you want to say selling points, or what I was saying, that it's this really the history of this should be saved.
Absolutely.
But, you know, it's hard. You couldn't, I mean, it's called the Camden 28. But there, I think, are, you know, about 7 main people who are interviewed for the film. It really would have been impossible to have all 28 people in there.
Right.
You just wouldn't have had the story the way it plays out in the film. I think people would have been confused, you know, if you had everybody in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, but there was every effort to contact everyone, because then I wanted to hear their story and just sort of see what would be the best story within there.
Right.
The only reason I did is because I can't stand to see a grown man beg. And Anthony was just begging me, you know. He'd be knocking on my door, you know, send me a box of chocolates. And so I finally gave in.
Yeah.
Well, independent filmmakers are used to begging. So,
yes.
Yes, they must be. Yeah, he does it very well.
I don't know if you know that this story. Actually, it was funny. The first time when I called one of them, Gene Dixon, is in the film. First time I talked to him, I asked him if he would, if I could interview him, and he said, his first thing he said was, he said, well, sure, but you really think you're going to sell more than 28 copies? Right? Because he thought, well, who's going to really care about this story now?
Yeah.
But it's been nice that it's been out there now, you know, so.
Yeah.
I would have always think of that when he told me that. And 10 years later, how things have turned out.
Right.
Well, you said that this film took over 10 years to complete, would you say? Tell me a little bit about the struggles during that time, you know, being an independent filmmaker and trying to make ends meet and the hours of footage that you're working with. Could you speak to those struggles a little bit?
Well, it was 96 that we first heard the story. Now, it was Father Doyle is the pastor of Sacred Heart Parish. It's where my parents go to church down in Camden. So that's, I mean, I came to it because a high school history teacher who also goes there told me about it. And me and a good friend of mine, Dave Dougherty, he is the director of photography on the film. We were looking for something local, a story, you know, because we wanted to do a film together. I studied history. He did communications. So we came to this story, but both of us had regular jobs. I lived in New York, and at the time I had just started, well, 95, so about a year before working at the History Channel. Mm-hmm. And because I had a regular job, Dave had a regular job, it was only something that we could do on weekends, on, you know, vacation time, filming. We started filming in 98. I think we started doing interviews, John. That's when we did yours.
Something like that. When did you come out to my place?
The first time I think we came out in 97. And then we came back and we did an interview in 98. So it was really just very, very slow moving in the beginning, because this was coming out of our pockets initially. There was no major funding for this. And like I said, we both had regular jobs. So that's part of the reason why it took so long. It was just financially and time constraints.
Right.
And I would imagine, too, it was difficult because I know you had to have been working with so much footage to kind of find your connective thread.
Right, right. And that was – there was over 100 hours of footage when it was – you know, at the end of the day, there was over 100 hours of footage. And the film is 82 minutes long.
Goodness. Wow.
So, yeah, so cutting that down – and, you know, I'll tell you, I had started I learned how to edit Final Cut Pro.
Okay.
So, and I did it for about 3 years. I edited, and again, this was also now on weekends and evenings, and finally, it was in, you know, in the spring of 2004. I just really had hit a wall. I couldn't, just because I knew all of the footage and all of the stories. I just lost perspective on the whole thing, and I just felt I couldn't do it anymore. I got through the first part, and I was up to the trial. And I just thought I really have to get somebody here who doesn't know the story, an editor who can be more objective than I can
right.
with this. So that's what I did, and I found an editor, and it was great. It was like the best thing that I did for the film because he was looking at things so much differently. He would say, well, I don't understand why is he saying this doesn't make any sense to me. Well, it would make sense to me because I knew all of the references he was talking about because I knew the whole story, but to somebody else, you know, who's coming in might not be able to make any of these connections. So he was able to really help shape that and sort of strip it down to the essential story. Like I said, it was the best thing.
John, what was your reaction when you saw the finished film?
Oh, it was incredible. It really was. I'll tell you, I knew Anthony was going to do a dynamite job, and he and David really captured this thing. When he sent to me like a five-minute promo, and that was several years ago. It was just 5 minutes on an old VCR tape. And I looked at that, and there were just clips. I mean, we're talking 30 seconds of Gene's interview or my interview and maybe a minute of Nick Doyle. And I looked at it, and I thought, these guys know what they're doing. Because until then, I really didn't know. I hadn't seen any of Anthony or Dave's work. So we were all just winging it. And
we had very little work, you know.
Yeah.
At that time. Yeah, but, you know, I'll tell you, I was, you know, for me, I was a bit very nervous for these guys. Mm-hmm. Actually, I wasn't so nervous with you, John.
Because, you know, I would just walk out if I was fed up with it. Yeah.
Right. Well, I just, you know, I mean, we had just always been talking so much about
right.
And Gene, I guess maybe a little bit with, maybe with Doyle I was a little bit. Certainly mm-hmm. with Bob Hardy I was.
Yeah.
You know, because he's seen the film. But anyway, John, I cut into you. I'm sorry. You,
No, that's quite all right. But I was just, to answer your question directly, I thought it was incredible. I'm trying to remember the first time I saw it.
Well, you
was
saw
it
the,
before
the,
one of the film festivals? Didn't you send me a CD before the
you
film festival?
Well, you came up to Camden when we did that final fundraiser.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah. And it was just incredible. It really was.
But it was,
I just thought you guys did such a dynamite job. We have hundreds of hours.
Yeah.
And you have to put it into 90 minutes.
But
you know, that's why I laughed earlier when you mentioned editing. I mean, what an incredible editing job.
Yeah, well, I was I may have even sent it to you beforehand because it was sort of important for me that people saw it before they came to like a movie because the thing is that I think that all the Canon 28 they're really 28 stories when it comes to what everyone's going to have their own memories of this and when you watch it that first time it's not going to square totally with what you remember. I think, because you're seeing other people's point of view as well.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think that what's my experience has been that after they've seen it a couple times, they've then really been able to sort of open up about it and talk about the film.
Yeah. Well, I thought my interviews were truthful. I don't know about anybody else's, though. I still have some doubts about the other 27. But.
Excuse me, Anthony, is there a way for our listeners to see this film? It going to be picked up on PBS on their point of view?
Yeah, it's going to be on the PBS series POV, and the air date is September 11th.
Okay.
And you'll have to have them check their local listings.
Yeah, obviously, for that show, yeah, you got to check your local listings.
And that says something of the power of your movie as well, that PBS reserved that kind of sacred date to air it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was surprised. I was surprised when they picked that. But yeah, so that's the PBS date. But before that, for anybody in New York, it's going to actually, this may even be news to John now because I just got this. July 20th, it's going to be playing starting at Cinema Village.
Oh, great. Congratulations.
In New York. So, and I know that it's going to have a week run, and depending on how well that goes.
Right.
They may.
Are you going to have it play at Silver Docks, the Anthi Silver Docks?
No, it would have been for last year.
Okay.
And it's just a strange story. It didn't make it in. I mean, I had conversations with them and stuff, but they didn't take it. But no, it would have been a film for last year.
Oh, it would have been perfect for them. It would have been the perfect film. I'm surprised.
In the meantime,
you can talk to those people down there.
Okay.
In the meantime, our listeners can read all about your film at camden28.org.
That's right.
Is that correct?
That's right.
And that's the number 28.org.
Yes, number 28. And up there, and we'll also put, and they can actually go to firstrunfeatures.com, because First Run Features is the distributor.
Right.
And they will, as more cities open up, because the plan is to play in Chicago and Boston.
Right.
I'm in L.A. They could find out through their website, as well as mine, exactly when it's going to be playing and where.
Okay.
I just want to close the interview. Our topic of the week that we're going to tackle in just a couple of minutes is, can movies make a difference?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to get both of your opinions on this. Do you believe that they can, and do you think that the documentary form is the ideal forum to inspire such a difference?
Well, John, I'll answer first.
Go ahead, Anthony.
I think that on a personal level, they certainly can make a difference. And my reason for saying that is because it was like 1987 or 88. Around that time is when I first saw the series Eyes on the Prize. You know that series?
Yes, I do. Yes.
The Civil Rights Movement. And that really, that's the first time I heard the story of Emmett Till. And being able to see the images, right, and then, seeing the interviews, and I started thinking a lot about that, about this idea of how history on film could be very powerful and also important. So personally, that's one of the things that got me interested in documentary filmmaking. So certainly for me, but if you just look at, the first film that popped in my head was An Inconvenient Truth, for example.
That seems to be the popular one, yes.
Right? I think that that's a way for people to really to be exposed to the whole question of global warming and then, maybe do something about it personally. So I think so.
Definitely.
I believe they can.
Okay.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I am willing to bet, so to speak, for lack of a better word, that there are a fair number of people around this country now, because this film has really gone all over the place, mm-hmm. that have been moved to get involved in today's anti-war movement because they sat in the theater one day and watched Anthony's film. I'm absolutely convinced of that. I mean, they do make a difference.
I am one of those people that was moved by the film. I can attest to it.
Yeah.
It's just a wonderful achievement, and God bless you both. Thank you both so much.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yes, thank
you. Good luck with the film.
Thank you. I'll make sure that I'll send out from the website people to listen into this. I guess it'll be archived.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Perfect. All right, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, Jamie, thank you very much. I don't know anybody else's name. Anthony, good talking to you.
Yes, good talking to you. Jerry, right?
Yes, Jerry. Yes,
yes Jerry.
Oh, Jerry. That's right. I did hear that earlier. Okay.
Yes. Thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you.
All right. Enjoy.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right.
All right.
That went well.
That went very well. I guess we're going to bring in Chris now.
Our first official interview went very well.
Yes, it did. Congratulations. You did an excellent job.
No, you too. Okay, let's stop congratulating each other. Let's bring in Chris. Bring on Chris. Hang on. Chris, are you there?
Hey, I'm here. How you guys doing?
We're good. You didn't fall asleep on us there, did you, Chris?
No, of course not. I was listening for the whole thing.
All right,
like,
cool.
Like everybody else. I'm really, really interested to see this story on the screen. I hope I get to soon. I'll definitely be watching on PBS.
I urge everyone to do whatever it takes to look at the website for updates, find out where and when this movie's playing, and race to go see it no matter what you have to do. But he brought up an interesting film that we are going to discuss tonight in terms of can movies make a difference, and that's The Inconvenient Truth, An Inconvenient Truth. Since that's our topic this week, that seems to be one that has really raised social consciousness about the global warming issue. And probably the most recent example of a movie that could make a difference. What do you guys think?
I think that's probably the best example. It's also, I'm glad Anthony brought that up, but it also, I was thinking about this, it is also the classic textbook example. It seems like the standard yearbook answer, and I think, this film could go a number of directions, just this weekend there's talk of the Gore's campaign people are meeting in secret.
Are they really?
Oh, yes. I'm not making this up. This is very true, and this film will probably is the, this film has sort of like, I guess you could say Fahrenheit 9/11 ramifications. Is the film going to be the thing that propels him into the election?
Yeah. This could be his calling card for the election.
It is his calling card. I mean, yeah. Everyone said he's run. They asked many political operatives in the D.C. area a year ago, and they said that Gore is running the best campaign you can run without actually officially declaring he's running.
Yeah, I think that's exactly how he's running his campaign.
Yeah. But Gore... The Gore the movie star and Gore the candidate are two different things. And Gore the candidate is not, as far as I'm concerned, a very attractive... I want to see this Gore that we see now become the candidate. I don't want it to go back to the robotics.
Yeah, but movies have kind of that power about them because they're seen by global audiences.
True.
So if he kind of sticks to... The Al Gore that we got to know in An Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
I think he's got a real shot. By the same token, when Fahrenheit 9/11 came out, everybody was kind of raving about this will mark the end of Bush. This will put the nail in the coffin, so to speak. But it didn't quite work out that way.
It didn't work out at all. It was actually really – I mean, I remember getting an email from a friend the day after she saw it, and it was like – someone had, like, she had seen the light, and I really wanted to send back an email and say, you don't read a daily paper? This shouldn't be news to anyone. I was kind of surprised that, and we were all caught up in the hoopla that summer.
Do you think it has more to do with Fahrenheit 9/11 was viewed as it should be, because it is, I believe, as a piece of propaganda?
I think so, and it's a very effective piece of propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
he is a filmmaker. No doubt about it.
Here's the joke about Fahrenheit 9/11. 2 weeks later, a much better movie came out called The Corporation, which went right to the core, went way beneath the surface of what Michael Moore was just touching on. And that film, I thought, really went into a lot of things that Michael Moore, he's a showman, first and foremost. I know people like to think of the documentary filmmaker. He really is a showman.
Yeah.
I mean, he is in his own way a P.T. Barnum, if you want, of documentary filmmaking.
Right.
Yeah, that movie Fahrenheit 9/11. It's got some. It does have in its heart the idea that it wants to let the audience know about how this administration is misleading them. But it also really gets into a lot of sensationalism,
Very, very much so.
They stay for a long time on the issue of, you know, how long did it take him to react when he was reading Mike's
note
or whatever it was?
Yes.
And, you know, in the end, at the end of the day, is that really that important? I mean, he is the president. He is a human. I think a lot of people had a lot of time, you know, reacting
to
the gravity of that situation.
Yeah,
I mean,
you're right. There's a lot of sensationalist elements in that film.
Frankly,
but that's also his style. And
I preferred Bowling for Columbine. As a documentary, I think that he asked a lot of questions that aren't asked enough. He didn't necessarily have the answers, but the important thing was that he let the questions out. You know?
Right. There's not a lot of question asking going on in Fahrenheit 9-1-1. There's a lot of finger pointing, a lot of accusations.
Yeah.
No room for discussion.
No, there is. That's the problem. That's what I did. And I think, you know, when you, all right, take the election year politics out of it and everything, that's the problem with the film. It is all just accusations. It's not, I know, Jamie, you were not crazy about it. I remember reading your review, but I actually thought the Eugene Jarecki film, Why We Fight, was head and shoulders above Fahrenheit 9/11.
As a documentary, yes. When I reviewed Why We Fight, I was kind of reviewing the filmmaking, comparing the kind of, I found it to be kind of shoddy filmmaking.
I'll give you that. But I think
the same can be said of Inconvenient Truth, really, I think.
It's a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah, I know it won Best Documentary, and it won Best Documentary because, you know, I mean, the Motion Picture Association, they're very liberal, and this is an important issue on both sides of the aisle.
You got Lori David there and Larry David, so of course they're going to...
As far as a movie goes, it's not a great movie, you know. I mean, it needs to be out there. People need to know about it, and that's why, you know, we're talking about, can movies make a difference? In that capacity, yes. That's why it points to Inconvenient Truth, because there's people out there eating cheeseburgers and tossing the wrapper out the window and, you know, in a Hummer, and they don't know about what's going on. Those people need to sit down and watch Inconvenient Truth.
Right.
Frankly, I gave a lukewarm review to an Inconvenient Truth as well. I like the content of his presentation, but I thought all
the presentation.
The inserts that went through the election and all the kind of personal stories, I felt that we didn't necessarily need that. It seemed like, woe is me, the election was stolen from me. Now back to global warming.
Right.
You know, it felt very out of place. We have a caller, and I think I know who this caller is. It's our friend Mark. Let me get him on the line here.
All right, cool.
Mark, are you there?
I am.
Are you calling live from SeaWorld?
I actually got done with SeaWorld, so Shamu's not in the background or anything.
Oh, good. So what do you think about our topic this evening?
I have to kind of preface it, too, because you remember how excited I was whenever Fahrenheit 9/11 came on.
Yeah.
And I got into an argument with our mutual friend Joe about how it was this, and he thought it was, he thought it was like complete garbage and bullshit, and I thought it was, you know, a very powerful, you know, piece. And in retrospect now, I can say that as far as Michael Moore is concerned, I mean, I think he does a really good job of bringing a certain amount of information to the masses. Not necessarily, though. He kind of has this way of being his own worst enemy, though, because he gets enamored with the whole concept of Michael Moore, and, you know, he's everyone's watchdog, and, you know, he's there to fight the good fight and everything like that. I mean, in all honesty, besides Bowling for Columbine, I think one of his best works is Roger and Me, or even, you know, The Awful Truth, or whatever that show was that he had on Showtime a time ago.
I'm going to throw this out and just comment on it. Michael Moore is the Oliver Stone of documentarians.
You really didn't want to throw that out there with me, did you?
Discuss.
I'm going to go first.
Okay.
Because I'm one of the hosts. And I think there's a level of truth in that statement, but it's not a good thing. I think, and I've been thinking about this a lot for a couple of years, I think they're both, and I'll go back, they're both very good showmen. I think they both get wrapped up in who they are. They are their own worst enemies, and this goes for Oliver Stone in his heyday. The man should never do press for his movie. Never. Never. And let me tell you why. Because he has this thing of so self-importance that, oh, my movie is the truth. This is the way you look at it. Bullshit. Shut up and let the film talk for itself.
Exactly.
Get off Larry King. You're making a mockery of yourself.
Exactly.
I mean, I really want to say his best film is Salvador to me and always will be Salvador. It's by
That's a movie that, you know, a lot of these movies we're talking about, like Inconvenient Truth, that's a movie that's trying to make a difference in
yes.
what the truth is. And a movie has to, you know, when you're talking about a guy like Oliver Stone, who some of his movies you can point to and say maybe they raised a little awareness about, you know, the situation in Salvador or something like that.
Yes.
But it is also, at the same time, Salvador, an entertaining movie.
Yes,
and that's
it
what
is.
Oliver Stone forgets a couple times in his career is that movies, on the whole, they're first and foremost, they're supposed to be entertaining. You know?
Amen.
And you know what? Michael Moore makes entertaining films.
Right.
He knows how to make you laugh. I was thinking in terms of they're both rabble rousers. You know, that's their place. They want.
Yeah.
They should be there to get a fire up under you. You know, I think that's how they work best. Mark, are you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. I mean, I think
good for you.
I'm listening to you guys. I'm, being entertained right now. But no, I think it's more along the lines that, you know, where Bowling for Columbine at least brought the issue of gun control in America to the masses, or at least to a small percentage of you know, the population. And you know, Americans are going to go gun crazy, and especially in the light of this Virginia Tech shooting
right.
that happened, you know, this past week. I think Fahrenheit 9/11 was just. It was just too mean-spirited. I mean, I really think that, you know, it's exactly what Chris says. I mean, you do want to be entertained. Sure, I want to be informed and everything, but at the end of the day, I don't want to leave the movie theater being pissed off. You know, especially something that I'm going to recommend, you know, for entertainment purposes. I would have to agree with you know, what Chris is saying. So,
yeah,
but
why the movie's in the bargain bin right now? You go to Walmart, you can pay $5. Oh yeah.
I did not know
that. If it's even being sold at Walmart, because I know they were having a really difficult time trying to get it sold anywhere. So.
Yeah, wow.
Walmart and Fahrenheit 9/11 are an odd combination.
That's a very odd couple.
Yeah. Thanks so much for calling in, Mark.
Yeah, thank you.
I appreciate it, man.
Yeah. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, man. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
We got two more callers. I want to get them in before.
Yeah,
we
let's get them in. Let's
close down the show. 717 area code. Let's hear you out. Go ahead.
Hey guys, it's Ty.
Hey Ty,
what's up?
How's it going? Love the show. Awesome.
Thank you.
I just want to chime in, if I may. On the whole Michael Moore. First of all, Michael Moore, like Rush Limbaugh, is a big fat idiot. Okay, just let me get that out in the open. Second of all,
well, he is.
You know,
he
lost a lot of weight though.
Yeah. Well. So is Rush, if you think about it. All that OxyContin has paid off.
Exactly. Well, you know, that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
My question is, doesn't a documentary, isn't it supposed to show both sides of a story?
Yes.
And let you make your own opinion at the end?
Yes, you're absolutely right.
Now, Fahrenheit 9/11, it did not do that at all. It was extremely one-sided.
Mm-hmm.
Extremely. So I just... You guys can go with that. I just wanted to throw that in there and let you
know. Ty, I think you're absolutely right.
Ty brings up...
Actually, one of the movies I saw this week, Lake of Fire, I was talking about it earlier, 2.5-hour film. It's an exhaustive film about the abortion debate, and it's noteworthy because it is completely... it does completely represent both sides of the issue fairly. But I'm thinking... It's not going to change minds. It's not going to necessarily raise consciousness. You know, anyone that believes one thing is going to walk out believing that same thing.
Right.
I don't know. Do movies have the power to change minds?
Good movies
do. And I think Ty brings up a good point. This is actually a big controversy. It is a lot of these documentaries, whether they're on the right or the left, they're only preaching to the choir. They're not bringing in any level of discussion at all. They're only really saying, hey, we know you believe this, but we're going to talk to you anyways. They're not breaking any new ground in one sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for joining us tonight.
No problem, guys.
Thank you.
Enjoy the show. See ya.
Thank you.
Thanks, bud. Wow. This is great. We have our very own show, our very own callers. I feel like an official journalist. / radio host. How about you guys?
I do too. We got one more caller, or
we don't. They hung up.
Okay.
Yeah, and all of a sudden I was feeling good about myself, and then our last caller hung up on us. So.
I feel like an official asshole.
Yeah, really. So do I.
We got about 5 minutes left. Why don't we give our movie picks of the week? Does that sound good?
Sounds good to me.
We weren't able to get to them last week. Jerry, what have you got on the docket?
Well, do they have to be movies that make a difference, or could they be anything? Could they be leftovers from last week? Or
they could be the leftovers from last week. It could be anything.
Okay, I'm going to go. I had picked last week because our special guest intro was William Friedkin.
Right.
I had picked his 1983 bomb Deal of the Century with Chevy Chase. And the reason I picked it is because at that time, we're living in the Morning in America period, and a couple of great satires came out that didn't do very well, the other being Blake Edwards' SOB, which is one of probably the best black comedies on Hollywood. Deal of the Century is about a group of arms dealers led by Chevy Chase, and it's a great send-up of the whole evil empires and the wars in Central America, and it bombed. Friedkin never did comedy again. Although his later films, like Jade, could be definitely classified as comedy, he never did black comedy again, and it's a shame because it really does work. And especially when you watch it again, it's like it is actually a really good black comedy.
And you could actually find that movie in the $5 Walmart bin next to Fahrenheit. Right?
I think they give it away, actually, if I'm not mistaken.
If you buy Fahrenheit, you get a free copy of Deal of the Century.
You do.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to mock your...
I think William Friedkin is writing me a fan letter right now.
Yeah. Well, he's definitely not writing Chris a fan letter, our in-house William Friedkin impersonator. Chris, what about you? What's your pick of the week?
I am going to recommend a brand new movie, which I think is in kind of like a medium release, not completely wide, but it's not just New York and L.A. I saw it yesterday, and it's Hot Fuzz.
Oh, great movie.
Oh, my God, was this movie funny. And, the previous part, because I love Shaun of the Dead, you know, the same director, writer-director Edgar Wright with Nick Frost and Simon Pegg. I love that movie. I think it's, I own it. I think it's just so funny, and I never thought that another movie of theirs could be as funny as that, and especially from the previous for Hot Fuzz, it didn't look like it was going to be anywhere near as funny.
Right.
This is the funniest movie that I've seen in a couple of years. It blows every recent comedy out of the water.
It blows away Borat?
Oh, it blows Borat out of the water, in my opinion.
So what is it? Does it play as a spoof, and what is it spoofing?
It's spoofing these action movies, like Lethal Weapon, Die
Point
Hard.
Break.
Bad Boys 2, those two specifically, and it does it perfectly. And I was just having such a fun time with this movie. I mean, talking about a movie that can make a difference, it made a difference in my underwear because I pissed my pants halfway through.
Well, that's a glowing recommendation.
That is. I don't think you could get a better recommendation than that.
Absolutely.
I saw it with four other people, and everyone felt the same way. We had a blast.
Well, they ruined their pants, too?
We went immediately to Walmart to pick up Fahrenheit 911, Deal of the Century, and a package of underwear for all of us.
Okay, that's good. I'm glad to hear that.
All right, my pick of the week, I've raved about this on my movie blog before, is The Assassination of Richard Nixon.
You and Tony Farinella, okay.
Yeah, it's a movie that not a lot of people have picked up, and it's surprising. It's on video now. It stars Sean Penn and Naomi Watts. It's got a great cast. But it basically is, I believe, the best depiction of a mental breakdown since Taxi Driver. And I really think that it is Sean Penn's Taxi Driver. I would highly recommend it. I it was the most moving movie for me by far last year, Camden 28 being this year. But definitely go pick that up to anyone that's in the market for a good moving Sean Penn performance. You can't get any better than that one.
Good.
That's interesting.
Yes. All right, I want to thank everybody for joining us tonight. Next week, Chris will be with us every step of the way.
Thank God.
I was with you every step this week.
I wasn't
saying anything.
No. I mean,
you were there. Your presence was felt.
Our listeners look forward to hearing from you.
Yeah, they love you.
You're the life of the show.
I look forward to giving them an earful.
And I know you mean that in more ways than one.
I do mean it in about seven different ways.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us tonight. Check out our MySpace page, myspace.com/MovieGeeksUnited. About the middle of the week, you're going to hear an update on the contents of next week's show. It'll be an audio file. But thanks so much, everybody, for joining us.
Yes, thank you.
We're signing off.
Okay.
All right. Good night.
Good night, everyone.
Please enter your security code.